Discussions of the opioid drug crisis often get well beyond the original reason for using drugs, which is pain, of course. People take OxyContin and other opioids or did it first because they were suffering with pain, but the drugs turned out to be much more addictive than first thought. Just a few weeks ago on this program, we heard from Humboldt County, California officials who filed suit against opioid manufacturers, alleging that those companies misled health providers about opioids' addictiveness. And just last week, Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum announced a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, that alleges Purdue Pharma lied to the state of Oregon about targeting senior citizens with opioids. To help combat opioid abuse, the Oregon Health Authority put out guidelines on prescribing opioids for chronic pain 2 years ago, and now a task force is wrapping up work on guidelines for using opioids for acute pain. There is also a proposal under consideration to stop giving opioid prescriptions to certain Oregon Health Plan patients for certain diagnoses. Who are using those drugs for chronic pain, I should say. And joining us from the OHA this morning to discuss the task force's recommendations is Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who is the state health officer for the Oregon Health Authority. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning.
And also we have Dr. Kat Buist, who is a pain psychologist and an assistant professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the in the School of Medicine at Oregon Health Science. Oregon Health and Sciences University. Good morning, Kat. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So, Dr. Hedberg, I want to start with you this morning. Is this attention to acute pain now intended to keep people from exposure to opioids in the first place?
Well, I think the issue about opioids, of course, is that they're an incredibly powerful medication. The vast majority of us have gotten opioids at some point, whether it's been for a surgery, having wisdom teeth removed, et cetera. So these really are very powerful and effective medication. I think the issue comes not with whether or not these are useful for acute pain, depending on how severe it is, but whether or not people then, what are the other modalities that you try? And we do know that if people are getting opioids for acute pain, the longer they stay on them, the more likely they are to both become tolerant and then potentially the issue of addiction. And so focusing on acute pain is that we want people to have acute pain being treated, being managed. But these are risky medications because of that long-term use, and so we're trying to do guidelines to prevent that longer-term tolerance from happening.
So, Dr. Buist, we've had a number of experts on our show in the last year as we've covered the opioid addiction problem who have said that there's increasing research that's showing that really sort of more old-fashioned pain medications are effective where opioids are being prescribed now. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not a prescriber. I'm a pain psychologist. But I would say that for chronic pain, the best evidence-based treatment is really a multidisciplinary approach. So it's engaging other types of treatments such as acupuncture or yoga or aqua therapy. And medications can certainly be a part of that toolbox, but it should never be the only part of it.
So the recommendation then would be don't just immediately prescribe opioids.
That's correct. I think that the evidence shows that what happens for people when they have pain is often to guard and protect, and they often stop moving. So part of helping people get back to their lifestyle is helping them move and doing it in the right way through pacing and other kinds of techniques as well. And also learning about the fact that when we have pain, the brain often interprets that as a chronic stressor, and so it can often activate the body's stress response. So teaching things and engaging people in mindfulness and breathing and movement and improving their sleep can have a significant improvement on helping them manage their pain more effectively.
So, Dr. Hedberg, did your task force have any indication in all the meetings and the public comment periods that you've had for before the release of your recommendations, did you have any indication of what the typical initial prescription is now for chronic pain for opioids?
So one of the things that was looked at, we know that there in many
sort of healthcare systems, there's kind of a default, and that's often 30 pills or 30 days supply to make sure. And part of this is not that there's an expectation people will necessarily take all of that, but you take them PRN, so as needed, and if you need more, you know, then you can have more. There are many studies that show that people post-surgically, regardless of the type of surgery, take a fraction of those. And I think we've all had that experience. Take these if you you need for pain, and then you're like, well, actually the pain is better, and these pills are making me constipated or making me woozy. People stop taking them, and then the medications are in the medicine cabinet. So again, we do know from published reports that too many are being prescribed, both perhaps to too many people, many of whom could be treated, again, for acute pain with things like, you know, let's say you sprain your ankle, elevate your foot, take ibuprofen, use ice, those kinds of therapies that you can be quite effective. And if somebody needs opioids, prescribe, you know, most of the time, fewer than 3 days supply, occasionally less than seven, but then really reevaluate what's happening at that point, because too many of these drugs were being prescribed, and again, leftovers were being, you know, in the medicine cabinet that were potentially available for misuse.
So there's some concern that if you have, you know, some Vicodin from 8 years ago when you broke your wrist, that either you're going, those pills might end up in the wrong hands of somebody for whom they were not prescribed, or that patient might then self-medicate down the road when they say, oh yeah, I just, I've got a slight pain in my elbow, maybe I'll hit this Vicodin again.
Yeah, I think it's both of those. Again, that's one of the kind of legs of the stool, if you will. We want fewer prescribed in the first place, and then there has been a fair amount of discussion about increasing access to drug disposal. Right now, police departments often have, and some hospitals. I think a couple of pharmacies have started, Walgreens and others, but we would like to make access to disposal more easy, so fewer drugs prescribed in the first place, and then the ability for people to adequately dispose of the drugs that they have not used at, you know, after they need them.
We're talking about the new guidelines for prescribing opioids for acute pain this morning here on the Jefferson Exchange, draft guidelines just published by the Oregon Health Authority. Our guests are Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who's the state health officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and also Dr. Kat Buist, who is a pain psychologist in the School of Medicine at OHSU. You can join the conversation this morning by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So what types of patients are these guidelines intended to focus on? For example, are these guidelines excluded for people who are, say, being prescribed opioids, you know, at the end of their lives, say, in a hospice situation?
So again, pain you can really think of as a continuum. Most pain, not all, you know, all pain starts with some acute, so you're having at some time, you know, most people, and I won't say 100%, but you're not born with pain, it develops at some point. So if you're talking about acute pain, that's what the current guidelines are addressing, and it's primarily pain that might be seen in emergency departments, urgent care, primary care, post-surgical, so that's an acute event as well, and dental guidelines, another acute event if you have, you know, dental pain, and so it's prescribing for acute in those situations. Then there's the chronic pain, and oftentimes that chronic pain, that's where the previous guidelines came out, but those are the things like chronic lower back pain, and certainly people have other types of chronic pain. That's where this longer, that Dr. Buist was referring to, the kind of treating with a variety of modalities. So in all of the guidelines that we are talking about, you are absolutely right. They do exclude people who are in hospice care, cancer, those kinds of things, because, again,
folks that have those type of, pain, we don't want people to suffer. That's not the intention. The intention here is to really focus on improving health and safety of people who are taking these medications. At the end of life, we want to be sure that people who are dying, by definition, they're at the end of life, are not suffering during that time and do have access to adequate medications.
So is a provider who accepts these guidelines bound by them, or does an individual provider have discretion based on what he or she sees are the needs of a patient?
So all of the guidelines that we have done, both these acute guidelines, which are the new draft, as well as the chronic guidelines, which have now been in effect for a year and a half now, are just that. They are guidelines, and they are being endorsed by the various health systems, practice groups. We have the different boards at the table. But these are not in statute. They are not law. However, what we're trying to do, of course, is to change the standard of practice, not to get rid of the use of opioids, particularly for severe acute pain and end of life, as you had mentioned, but really limit the amount that is being prescribed in the first place. So these are guidelines. The recommendations do talk about amounts, but they talk about a lot of other things as well. And I think the chief other things that they are talking about is an ongoing discussion between the prescriber and the patient about how much pain, what type of pain, what are the variety of things that that patient has tried. And so even when refills might be happening, and then documenting that so you can see whether or not the patient is improving or not, and what are the things that you can do to focus on maintaining functional status. So that's really the biggest kind of tenet of this, is to have an ongoing conversation, document, and don't think pain should not be equated with opioids or opioids with pain. If you have pain, there are a variety of things that can be done, of which, again, as Dr. Deuce mentioned, pain or medication is only one of the tools in the toolbox.
Can I jump in here for just a second?
Please do.
To Katrina, is that what we've actually just released the new module for Oregon through the Oregon Pain Management Commission, released in January. It is it's actually called Changing the Conversation About Pain, and anyone can actually view this module for free. It was actually intended for about 15 different professions, and it's at OregonPainModule.org, but sometimes patients look at it as well, which is wonderful. But the idea is to open up the conversation when you're talking about pain management to include really the five domains of best pain care, which is addressing understanding pain, addressing sleep, addressing mood and how that plays a role in chronic pain, activity or movement, and nutrition. Because all of those elements can have a significant impact on the person's function and quality of life. So we do want providers to be addressing those in their discussions with the patients as well.
So, Dr. Buist, along those lines, you know, marijuana is obviously now readily available in Oregon, both medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. Do these guidelines see that as another viable alternative to opioids?
I think there's another task force working on the marijuana guidelines for that, right?
Yeah, so this is Katrina again, and I can address that a little bit, which is you are absolutely right. You use the word recreational. We like to use the word retail because, in fact, there are a number of people who are buying marijuana or cannabis for medical reasons. So, for example, they might be buying some of the salve or ointment or whatever if they have arthritis. And there might be different types of cannabis that work for them to help sleep, et cetera, and address pain. So we have a couple of ways of approaching that. We know that a lot of people are doing this because it's, again, available and legal in the state of Oregon. And so we have within our opioid prescribing guidelines, the chronic guidelines, we do address marijuana use, and basically it's what I said before, it's having a conversation between the clinician, the prescribing clinician, and the patient. Some clinicians are reluctant because if patients are using cannabis that has a fair amount of THC in it, that has psychoactive effects. We know that opioids are also a depressant, and they're worried that if people are using these on top of each other and they drive, for example, they might be at risk of falls, car crashes, those kinds of things. So it's assessing what the patient is doing, having a conversation, and then making a decision. Again, the focus here is not
pain, but if it should be function. Even if you have some pain, are you able to function and improving functional status? So that's one kind of avenue where we've addressed it within our chronic opioid guidelines. We also have some guidelines for clinicians around the recommendation of a medical marijuana card. So that's a little bit different. That's not for retail. The folks who get medical marijuana cards can get higher amounts and more concentrated, higher dose, those kinds of things. But again, the recommendations there are not specific to which condition, why, but assessing, focusing on functional status and is what the patients are doing, is that helping them maintain a high quality of life is really the focus. And, you know, the flip side is making sure that focusing on patient safety so that people are not at risk of either side effects directly from the medication or from things like injuries or other things related to, again, the psychoactive properties.
And I've had a lot of patients, majority of my patients have actually tried marijuana as an adjunct to their treatment, but I would say for most people it may be, again, part of the toolbox, but it certainly should never be the whole toolbox for managing the pain. It might be one part of it, maybe helps them sleep better. But it's really focusing on, like Katrina said, improving that quality of life and that function and getting people up and moving and getting back to the activities that give them a sense of joy and pleasure and purpose in life. Because chronic pain, what it tends to do is steal that away from people, and people stop doing things, stop getting dressed, answering the phone, going out and socializing with the people who give them support. And that in itself creates a lot of isolation. Increases depression, which that then tends to feed the pain also. We know from the studies of neuroplasticity that our brain is changing all the time depending on what you choose to allow it to focus on. So if the brain is constantly thinking about pain, it's going to be reinforcing that and making new neuronal connections that's reinforcing the pain. So we really want people to get back to activities that give them a sense of pleasure, and that improves the neuroplasticity of the brain and helps them change that focus away from the pain and do the things that give them a sense of joy.
We're discussing new guidelines for prescribing opioids for acute pain, those guidelines being issued by the Oregon Health Authority. Our two guests this morning are Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who is the state health officer for the OHA, and Dr. Kat Buist, who is a professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at OHSU. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-838-3760, or you can call or email us your question at jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to ask this question. Do these guidelines offer some measure of protection also for providers? I mean, we heard these anecdotes from the early stages of the opioid crisis that one of the contributors were providers who were not necessarily very assertive in challenging people's claims of pain because they might be afraid of being sued by a patient. Was that really an issue? And will these guidelines offer providers an opportunity to say, nope, I'm following these guidelines. I'm not going to prescribe you 90, pills of some kind of opioid?
Yeah, so I can't address that question specifically about lawsuits or not. What I can say is that it really is a conversation. We do want, so it isn't just we're focusing on providers, they need to stop prescribing, and, the patients can need to just live with that. The idea really is to have a conversation. Guidelines are just that. They are guidelines. They do, I think, one of the things that might help the conversation between a clinician and a patient is that we do then talk about the standard of care and how the standard of care might be changing. And so, again, the idea there is that you change the conversation, which is, no, I'm not giving you the medications because these medications are incredibly strong, powerful. People can overdose from them. And we saw a rapid increase in prescription opioid overdose deaths from the early 2000s up until about 2010 or 11. We started to see a decline in the prescription overdose deaths. But we saw here in Oregon that it really was a problem. So it wasn't just theoretical. People were dying from these prescription medications.
the guidelines really do, I think, facilitate a conversation where the clinician can then say, or the prescriber, look, you're in severe pain. Yes, I will be, you know, prescribing opioids, but right now the recommendations, it's limited to this number. Then we need to have a conversation about how well you're healing. What are the variety of things that are happening to you? What are you doing? How is the function improving? So it can change the conversation. So this is not just to provide cover for providers. It's actually to improve patient health and safety and to facilitate the conversation that basically the standard of practice is now not to give as many of these pills for such a long period of time as people have been doing more recently.
So just very briefly before we conclude this segment of the Jefferson Exchange, I understand that there's also the task force looked at a change in the chronic pain guidelines, but very specifically for certain people who are on the Oregon Health Plan and for certain diagnoses. Is that correct? Can you explain that very quickly?
So that's a different task force.
I understand.
A different part of the Oregon Health Authority. And so you're talking now about Medicaid patients and our Health Evidence Review Commission. The Health Evidence Review Commission looks at what the evidence is around treatment for various conditions. They did chronic pain about a year ago, looking at the guidelines around what different modalities or tools in the toolbox could be effectively used to treat chronic pain. Low back pain. And they're now addressing some of the additional issues. But that HERC process, or Health Evidence Review Commission, has been looking to see whether or not there are other types of chronic pain in addition to the lower back pain that could be effectively treated with other modalities. At the same time, we are having the Oregon Health and Sciences University look at some of the issues around chronic opioid use and helping to taper people off high doses of opioids and, the evidence base related to that. So that is in process right now, but it's a different task force, and like I say, it's in process.
We've been talking with Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who's the state health officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and Dr. Kat Buest, who is a pain psychologist at OHSU, looking at the recent draft guidelines for prescribing opioids for acute pain. I want to thank you both for spending the time with us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.